Welcome to Space Force, everyone. This is your weekly podcast doing post-show analysis of movies that came out 20 years ago. And I'm Jason Dondro.
I'm Jim Seals.
I'm Ed Smith.
I'm Professor Christopher McLaughlin.
And today's film on the chopping block is Star Trek Insurrection. Now, I curiously actually watched this movie not that long ago before rewatching it for tonight's show. And that's because I played Star Trek Online for a while. And the Riker maneuver and the Briar Patch are elements in the game. Like, there's several missions and episodes that take place in the Briar Patch. and characters are mentioning the Riker maneuver and stuff, and you can sort of pull off the Riker maneuver in the game. And I was like, where the hell is this all from? Because I don't remember this in the episode, in any of the episodes at all. And I think I asked you, Jim, I'm like, where's this shit from? And you said, oh, it's off of Insurrection. And I'm like, oh, okay. And then I turned on it, and F. Murray Abraham. Like, Salieri is the villain in this movie. I was sort of hypnotized by the simultaneous, I don't know, by the flaming train wreck that is Insurrection. And when I rewatch it again this last week, I don't know. I mean, it was okay. There was weird, silly bits. I laughed at the parts I was not supposed to laugh at, I guarantee. When F. Murray Abraham bursts a blood vessel on his head, you know, that was more absurd than scary. But at the same time, there were some cool bits. I don't know. But anyway, so Jim, set us up for this movie. Like, what was Star Trek like? Is Voyager still coming out at this time?
So this comes out in December 98.
Okay.
I am a sophomore in high school.
Okay.
So
nice.
So this is the movie that I realize that this Trek thing is going to go away. Because I go on opening day to a movie theater called Pompview, doesn't exist anymore, in Rivers Valley.
Okay.
I go to the movie theater, I'm the only one there. Opening night. Yeah. I'm singing an anti movie the first time this has happened. So this has happened to me twice. This was happening to me with this movie, and this happened to me with the Conan the Barbarian remake. Both movies that I love, probably because I saw them by myself in a movie theater.
Was Jason Momoa in that movie?
He was.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's as bad as I remember it to be. So this is 98 in terms of Trek lore. Deep Space Nine's in season 7. They all hit, and they haven't quite hit. I don't think they've quite landed with the 7 episode off to close it out.
Okay.
I think that comes out in June of the following year. And Voyager is, I think, in season 5. So they've already established 7 of 9. They've written off the cast character. So they're in sort of what Voyager fans consider like the peak Voyager.
Chris is laughing because peak Voyager is a pretty low ball, right?
Yeah, the peak Voyager for me was the first week I didn't have to waste an hour of my life on it.
You know, I watched the first 2 episodes of Voyager hoping for something really great, and I didn't get it. and the Neelix and all kinds of, like, you know.
Oh, God.
And so I just never felt compelled to return. And it's interesting. I'm kind of a hard sell on TV shows. Like, when I watched Enterprise, I watched the first episode, and the blatant pandering with, like, the Vulcan smearing radiation cream, you know.
Yep.
And I, like, do they think I'm fucking 12? Like,
yep.
Like, so I never watched another episode of Enterprise either.
I don't blame you.
You know, there was some good in both those shows.
Yeah, and that's
pull you out to a couple episodes and be like, okay, like, I'm not the giant, I'm not ride or die Voyager.
Yeah.
By any stretch of the imagination. I recognize what they were trying to do, which is they were trying to make a simple Star Trek in the sense of a ship by itself.
Yeah.
So it was closer to classic Trek because the captain had to make most of the decisions.
Yeah.
I like that on principle. I don't think they pulled it off in execution, but those are some really good episodes in there, and those are also some really good episodes in Enterprise that don't deal with the gel smearing scene. And they never shoot it the same way too. Like every time they go back to that room, it's just like three people bowled on a bench. Same way. Like, they would shoot it with the sexy lighting because I think it had like that blue filter from like Terminator 2. You know, it's just like the lighting I have in this room. People going, oh, we got to sit here for like three acts.
All right. Well, fair enough.
Okay. Yes. Yes.
All right. So the film comes out in 98, you say?
The film comes out in 98 and the franchise sputtles.
Yeah.
The film franchise sputtles. So at this point, Fourth Contact comes out, does big business. Generations comes out, makes a profit. Not exactly the big business they wanted for. And then Insurrection comes out, and it's there. They don't lose money. The studio doesn't lose money, but it doesn't make the money it wants to. And Next Generation movies will go on hiatus for about 4 to 5 years while they figure out what it is they need to do to change direction.
Or think that they need to do, because the resulting film is Nemesis. Which is not considered to be exactly one of the great films of Star Trek canon. Carrie, welcome. She says she agreed with Jim. About what? I have to get her to write back and tell us what it is she agrees with. So, Chris, do you want to pick it up from there? Or
all right. Well, okay. I want to get my first big thought out of the way, and then if you want big thought number two, I'll leave that up to you.
Okay.
All right. But here's the thing that has always astonished me about this movie.
Okay.
And I'll lay my card on the table.
Sure.
This to me, okay. I don't consider J.J. Abrams films to be actual movies, so I'm throwing them off the table.
Okay.
The remaining films, I actually think this actually raced past Star Trek V to be my absolute least favorite Star Trek film.
Okay, it's
and here's the and after feeling that way for about almost 20 years, on a work day, I got a hold of Michael Piller's unpublished book about the making of this film. Okay. And for those of you that don't know Michael Piller is one of the most consequential figures in Star Trek history that doesn't get talked about very much, because Piller effectively became the showrunner for the best seasons of Next Gen. Oh. And if you like Next Gen, this is the guy you mostly have to thank for it. And to me, the critical decision he made was he was the one who kept that horrible, insipid, unrealistic, unbelievable utopian bullshit rule that there's no character conflict in Next Gen. So Next Gen is what it is, love it or hate it, because of Michael Piller. And then Piller stepped away from the franchise, went off and did one of my favorite shows nobody's ever heard of called Legend. And I started thinking like, wow, I can do some things I like. Well, after Brannon Braga and Ron Moore turned down the opportunity to write this film, they went back to him. And he came up with a film that I would love to have seen the film that he wanted to do.
I see.
Yes, he wanted to do a film where it was basically going to be a cinematic riff on. It was going to be Heart of Darkness mixed with the Fountain of Youth.
Okay.
An old Academy friend of Picard's had launched a rebellion against the Federation, and Picard has to go track him down. They finds out that this guy is protecting the Fountain of Youth from being exploited by evil elements within the Federation.
Right.
So Picard has to say, Picard, who's experiencing the effects of becoming younger and more, well, frankly, Kirk-like,
yep.
You know, has to fight off the Federation by going to this sleazy corner of the galaxy and rounding up a ragtag fugitive fleet. If I can borrow something from another franchise. Of like space rebels and pirates to fight off the armada led by these evil elements of the Federation. And I tell you what, right now I am reflexively taking the money out of my wallet to go see this film three times.
Right.
I so want to see this film, and it was completely shot down by one thing: Patrick Stewart's fucking ego. Now, don't get me wrong. Patrick Stewart is a beautiful human being, and he gets that way the more older he gets. And is there anything we can aspire to more than getting better as we get older?
Yeah.
But in 1997, that man heard one suggestion of, "Well, are you suggesting I'm old?" and demanded a complete rewrite. And then we wind up with the shit we got.
So what Chris is overlooking that you'll enjoy, Jason, is that the movie was going to open with Boothby.
Okay.
So the movie opens with the cadet, and you find out why Picard was in trouble.
Okay.
So there was a plot element introduced in the episode False Duty, where Picard has to lecture Wesley on being honest and not having a lie of omission. Yeah. And they uncover this fact that if it wasn't for Boothby stepping in, he would have been kicked out of the academy.
And I
wanted to give you the short version of that. If any of y'all are really interested in finding out about that and many other wonderful moments, Pillar's unpublished book about the making of this film, he released it as a free PDF. You can Google it and read the whole thing. And he intended it as a textbook to show aspiring screenwriters and filmmakers, this is what happens. This is how a film actually gets made. And so it's a fabulous book, and it works on both levels. It really is a pretty good illustration of how films get made and the film that we could have had. So I strongly encourage everybody, Google it, download it, read it.
It's called Faden, The Making of Star Trek Insurrection.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the great tragedy of it all, that we're immediately compromised from the beginning, the story that Pillar wanted to tell. And I think would have actually been worth, you know, at 2 hours of my life, never got made.
Interesting. Abe, what are your thoughts on this film?
As previously mentioned, it's the film everyone forgets. it's the next generation film that just seems to slip by everyone's notice. I don't know why that is. I watched it yesterday and today in two parts, and I think it's because it's the one without the Klingons and the Romulans in it, and nobody can remember what the aliens are called, so therefore it's instantly forgettable. I think that's part of the problem. It doesn't. I mean, not every single movie has to have Klingons and Romulans, but I think that's it. The alien races didn't have much of an impact to be, these are new inventions for the movies, and oh my god, they're fantastic. It's like, well, yeah, space guys getting their skin stretched over their faces with you for 5 seconds, and immortal living. Again, I have mentioned in the notes before, the idea that the Baku are so damn happy all the while just pisses me off so much. They're so clapping each other on the back. Yeah, we live our happy lives. It's like the Smurf village in space. It just annoys me so much.
Even worse, it's the Smurf village constructed for about $30 entirely in beige.
But
when the movie started and all I saw were like blonde hair and white kids and looked like a Aryan training camp. And I just, I got really nervous. And then.
Oh, LeVar Burton has some choice quotes about that, even as they were making it.
Tell me.
LeVar Burton apparently was not shy about saying, like, so the perfect society has no black people in it, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, what do you say to the, first of all, that's indefensible on its face. And secondly, what do you say to the Reading Rainbow guy when he says that? That's like Santa Claus and Mr. Rogers saying, we're very disappointed in you.
Well, and his first job was Roots, for Christ's sake. Right?
Yeah. Again,
this is the problem, because making the Baku literally just humans. They've got no. They've not even got ears or anything to actually say these are aliens. So if you can forgive it, it's like if they're all green or whatever, you can say okay, right, they're all green. But making them literally human and having no racial mix up in there, it's just so weird. It's such a really stupid idea.
All right. So let's go back to the beginning. Okay. So when the film opens and we get this duck blind situation, right, where. The Federation is observing this culture, and the whole plot apparently is that it hinges on this idea that the Federation is harassed by multiple enemies. We've been watching Deep Space Nine. We've been seeing Voyager. That there's the Borg and there's the Dominion and there's the Romulans, and like everybody's picking on the Federation. And so we've lost a bunch of planets and we need a bunch of allies. And so we're willing to make compromises to get something that we need. And in this case, it's this planet of youth.
But that, even that as a plot device, as a justification, is horseshit. sorry, just as a matter of the idea, it's like, hey, let's pick the one planet that's got no telecommunications outside of the Briar Patch, has no space travel. They're the guys we want to ally with. That just seems to be a very silly idea anyway. So, but anyway.
Yeah, and really, right off the bat, you want to remind everybody there's a much more interesting story being told for free on your TV every week. I don't know if that was such a good choice for this story.
Now, isn't there a similar TOS episode where the people on the planet are like perpetually young and healthy, and McCoy ends up telling Crook something like, you know, the people live forever on this planet because they were born that way.
Like, oh, I think you're thinking of the Omega Glory. They wind up that way as a result of it's one of Gene Roddenberry's famous duplicate Earths. And on this one, China and America have a massive biological warfare, and their descendants live for hundreds of years because basically they're the ones who are tough enough to survive that level of germ warfare.
Oh, okay.
And there's also similar plot points in the episode The Apple. It's a recurring theme in Trek.
Is it?
Yeah.
It's another TOS episode.
Yeah. You know,
recurring Star Trek theme where people find a planet or a species that has long life or super health or whatever, and the Federation tries to get it and they can't or whatever. It becomes an ethical test. What are you willing to do?
Yeah. It's an example of why I'm so shattered that Pillar Script didn't get made because in Star Trek, if you just remake one story, it's a blatant ripoff. But if you can combine two stories, that's fresh and innovative. You know, back when it was going to be Heart of Darkness meets the Fountain of Youth, that would work. But when it started being Fountain of Youth plus a bunch of crap, you know, that just no. Forget it. It's not going to work.
So F. Murray Abraham plays the big bad guy in like Abe mentioned, like this race that is kind of invented for the, not kind of, which is invented for this movie, and which we find out ultimately isn't even another race at all anyway. It's the same race we've been seeing in the whole movie.
I mean, the Baku seem useless from the beginning, and then they explicitly tell you at the end that you don't need them. This film that was supposed to be about Picard launching a rebellion against the Federation. Yeah. I mean, what an incredible plot, so much potential, and in the end, his actual insurrection it has the same level as when I go over my copy limit at work. It seems to, it seems to have that amount of gravitas and actual effect of it. I mean, this is a film that at one point was going to involve Picard killing Data as a part of the cost of his rebellion. I mean, talk about making an ethical choice. You believe in something enough to kill one of your best friends over it. Yeah. And instead we wind up where Picard, you know, loads up his private, here you go. Yeah. Talk about sacrifice. He loads up his private yacht with a bunch of weapons and leaves the ship. And there you go, friends. There's your rebellion.
Yeah.
I live in Northern Virginia. We know that rebellions usually involve a little more than just loading up on your, loading your private yacht full of weapons and then heading down to Smurf Town for a little extended vacation. It underscores how far you got away from a great, great premise with a bunch of villains you didn't need. Make it, if you're going to have a fucking insurrection, show us a fucking insurrection. Make it Picard versus the Federation, right? not Picard versus Catherine Hellman from Brazil.
Again, this is part of the problem, because even though when Picard talks to the Admiral and mentions, oh, it's all been, and the Admiral says it's all been sorted by the Council, you can't go over my head about it, and by the time you put a thing in, it's still like, we still don't even know he's even telling the truth in that respect, because we don't even know the Federation even part of the actual plot of this at all. It could literally just be one guy and the bad guys, because there's no confirmation of anything else, and it's never mentioned again. So
when I was watching this film this last week, I was struck by how much of it is structured to avoid exposition. Like, I wanted somebody to just explain the goddamn story to me at some point. But instead, we find all these things are happening that just get referred to, and we have to sort of figure out what happened. Now, that can be done well, but I didn't feel like it was done well in this case. There just seems to be a great fear of ever having anybody sit down and tell us what's going on. Things just sort of happen. And we're like, wait a minute, why is this happening? What's the point of this? and we have this, you know, and it just seemed very clumsy, but you know, it was an impression.
Again, this is another fundamental thing about a lot of movie franchises, especially science fiction stuff, that kind of thing. There's all, by the second, third, or fourth movie, there's always an episode where, hey, they're shunning their responsibility and they're going to go rogue.
Yeah.
They did with this one, the second Abrahams movie, literally is that plot. And it only took one movie before that to do that plot. So, you know, it's just annoying.
Okay, so one of the things that happens in this film is the... And partially as a side effect of the youthening process that Chris already alluded to, like one of the subplots of this film is that the characters are all sort of exposed to the youthening effects of the planet, and so they all get and reckless. And some of them,
Patrick Stewart, because he is not old,
right? Yeah, so some of them get embarrassing, play for embarrassing comic relief, like poor Worf, right? Jim, you mentioned this. What's the name?
Oh God, yes,
it is a gorge.
A gorge.
Okay. Gorge.
Well, yeah, whatever it is. So he's played for comic relief, but in a more interesting take, it becomes a rekindling of the relationship between Troy and Riker. And we touched on this a little bit last film when we were watching First Contact, because that scene with Troy and Riker in the bar, where she's drunk and he's just kind of got this amused smile on his face the whole time, like, look at you, you're drunk. And it seemed like a really touching moment. Like, you really felt like these people had a history and they had a potential chemistry, and it seemed real to me, as opposed to a lot of overly staged fake that Star Trek can sometimes feel, especially when it tries to do romance. And that plot continues into this. Does it work, Jim?
I was going to say that before Jim. All I'm going to say is I think it's literally the best thing in the movie. Idea that because it sticks, they stick with it, and it continues onwards. And obviously, we get stuff all up to Picard.
Yeah.
I'm going to side with, like, I actually like this movie. This is my second favorite Star Trek movie.
So we're going to get you to defend that. All right, good. All right, so but. Tell us about the Riker Troy thing.
But for me, it's the nice thing about Star Trek. You know, it's a science fiction show, so you get these opportunities to put people in positions that, like, you watch all of Next Generation, and it's clear that the Riker Troy subplot is baked into the DNA of the show. It's something they will fall back to, but usually when they will fall back to it, one of the two characters are in a vulnerable position, usually Troy. It's either a violation of some sort. And in this time, we get the call back to them having, you know, saying, throwing caution to the wind, being like, you know what? We've been doing this long enough. We're adults.
Yep.
We'll just be playful with it.
Yeah, yeah.
And
I love when she says yuck and throws him out the room and shuts the door.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's fun and it's cute and it's not played. The nice thing about Michael in these two movies, and Michael and Troy in these two movies, is because he's directing, you know, Jonathan Frakes is directing them, they have to be choice cuts. Like, they really have to decide when is Jonathan Frakes going to step away from the camera and sit in front of the camera and act, and then come back.
I see.
So it's not like, this isn't Warren Beatty, Dick Tracy, where he's in every scene. This is, just give me like six scenes, I'll make the most of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And he just sort of acts his ass off. And it's one of the nice sort of, like, one of the elements that get introduced in this movie is that Picard was a Mamba dancer or something like that. And we've not seen any of that.
Yeah.
There's been no establishment of him at one point being a dancer. We've seen past flames of his. We've seen recurring romances with Picard.
Yes.
And at no point has he ever cut a rug. But here, we're told this, and one of the ways he realizes he's being younger is he starts dancing around his corridors. And it's a funny scene, but it doesn't feel old because it was never set up.
Yeah.
It was set up 20 minutes ago during the module sequence.
Right.
Well, everyone's coming to the call with a new problem, and he's having to walk. He can't walk 3 feet without someone handing him a pad or calling him up on the phone.
He has to wear that ridiculous headdress.
Yeah. And I do love the acting in that scene when Picard sits there and he's in that ready room and he's just tired. And then the door opens, and as the door opens, his smile comes on. He's like, I'm going to now do my job because I'm a professional. Like that's like those little acting moments, those little acting gems in this film is what sells it for me, that the structural, like everything you guys have said about the plot and that things happen and our characters kind of just knee-jerk react to them, they're all 100% justified. And it's like with Insurrection, sort of like, it's a flawed movie, but it's at least trying to say something.
Okay.
Which is very basic and very Trek-like in terms of, like, you know, like if we take the metaphasic radiation and say that's a metaphor for oil, you know, let's not destroy an environment. Let's not disadvantage a whole population of people so that we can get an edge that we can normally get if we do it slowly and patiently.
Now this is
okay. This is where I have to disagree with you the strongest.
Sure.
All right.
Because the reason for me that this is the worst of the legit Trek films is because it encapsulates all the three things that makes Next Gen not work for me. Number one being they pretend to ask big questions. I first noticed this during the high ground, the where they tried to make a comment on terrorism, and their big comment is it's really complicated and the hour's up, so we're literally beaming out without saying anything. And to me, this is another example of this. It's them puffing themselves up and patting themselves on the back for winning a straw man argument. I mean, they choose to do the ethical thing. Golf clap for that. But I mean, we never, ever, ever, except for one talk by Anthony Zerbe. And let's face it, when the presenting side has to be presented by Abner Devereaux from Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park or Matthias from Omega Man, you've got a straw man villain. And you've got a problem there. As much as I love Anthony Zerbe, great actor, but you don't bring him on for complicated moral arguments. We never see the millions of people whose suffering could have been alleviated by this metaphasic plotion mess, whatever it is. Nobody even questions, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. I've heard that somewhere before on some franchise. Look, I'm not saying that you have to wipe out Smurf Town as much as I'd love to drop a photon torpedo on it. But at least make an effort to put up a counter argument. The fact that this movie can't even be arsed to make it seem like any kind to make it seem like it's any kind of dilemma, they went total white hat, black hat. And to me, that's the Next Gen. They play at asking important questions, but they don't even attempt when they blatantly don't answer them. They do a crappy job of even posing the questions. And that's why, frankly, original series for all its space hippie episodes. Original series just drinks Next Gen's milkshake because they were willing to take a stand, even if it's one you don't agree with. If you watch A Private Little War and say, there's no way that Kirk should be handing these people weapons so they can increase the violence. They at least came up with a position that they presented both sides of the argument and took a stand, and you can like it or not like it. But this whole Next Generation thing of like, well, it's a complicated problem. And ooh, look at that. The hour is up. It's just total bullshit. And the only difference between Insurrection and typical Next Gen is this was 2 hours of bullshit.
But that's only one of the three things you don't like.
Well, yeah, I've got a couple more if you want them.
Well, you're on a roll, my friend.
All right. Well, I don't want this to be all me crazy old man ranting, so I'll happily take a sip of tea and let somebody else talk before I get to two and three.
Like you said, well, the idea that the planet is this kind of will help people regenerate, like we see with Geordi. Geordi grows his eyes back, okay? Now, that would have decent implication into Federation society in general. Why not build a Federation hospital on another island? There's only 600 people on the planet. You're telling me that there's no space to just build a Federation hospital? And they're supposed to be part of the Federation anyway, because that was the point of them coming in. Right. So the idea is like, okay, go and build, and that, there you go, job done. You don't have to take them off the planet. You could do that. And say, right, okay, you can have an extended leave on the planet. You stay in here for two years, whatever. You regenerate, you go away again.
When I was watching the show, and this is getting to Chris's point about posing a big issue, but kind of not actually dealing with it. And this is a common thread, I think. Jim, maybe this hooks up with your notion that Star Trek is trying to turn itself into Marvel. Because one of the things I've noticed about the Marvel films is they do this. They like the Captain America movies, pretend to be raising a big question like gun control or omni-surveillance or something, but then they don't actually really grapple with that issue. It's just kind of like, well, we're going to make a nod towards this civil issue that's going on in our society right now, but really it's about well-choreographed punching, right? when I was watching the film, about halfway through, like when Picard understands that they're going to relocate, and I actually kind of dig the whole cloaked, like holodeck trick ship. They're going to like make a duplicate of Smurf Town, which now I'm going to call it Smurf Town. they make a duplicate of Smurf Town in the holodeck, and then they're going to move everybody into there and then move the ship and relocate them on another planet. Okay, so presumably wherever they're going to move them to, they're going to look up into the stars at night and they're not going to see the Badlands or whatever the damn thing is called. So they're going to move pretty quickly that they're not where they used to be. Okay, we're going to just ignore basic astrophysics and instead make this. And then Picard has this observation like, well, no, we can't do that because every time we try to relocate an indigenous people, it always turns out bad. And I'm thinking the indigenous blonde, blue-eyed, and that was the biggest trick. I'm like, wait a minute, like, but they're not like indigenous. They're like that was, and that's where they. That's and Jim's nodding his head. Help me out.
Go ahead, Aiden.
No, so all I was going to say was the interesting fact about that is if you, again you go by the actual thing itself, Picard says to the admiral. Okay, well, you can't remove these people. Said, no, they're not. They arrived here in a starship. They're not even originated on this planet. They originated somewhere else. They came here so many years ago. That's it. Yeah. Well, sure, you can say the same about the Romulans because they were a Vulcan offshoot. So we could just go and bog over to Romulus and just kick them off. You're not even indigenous to Romulus. You come from Vulcan all millennia ago, but we have Romulus now. So again, that seems weird as well.
Yeah, Jim.
Yeah, I'm like. All right.
We're putting you in a hard spot here because he loves this movie, but then he's got to listen to all of us dig on it.
No, it's fine. Like, it's I understand this movie is flawed. Like, yeah. I'm not saying this is, I don't even think it's a really good, I think it's as close to a representation of Next Generation on the silver screen as we're ever going to get.
Well, and on that, we agree to 100%.
False Contact is Die Hard in space.
Yeah.
Right. And Generations is a mess. Like, it's not a representation of what Next Generation does. It's just an excuse to get two people together in a room cooking eggs.
This is why you liked. This is why you liked Final Frontier too. Not because it's a great movie, but because it's a great original series episode.
Yeah.
Right. And so you like this one because it's a great TOS episode, or at least. It's as much of a Next Generation episode as it can be.
Yeah, because the next movie we're going to get is Nemesis, and that's not a representation of anything except for another coffee and salted food. Insurrection is flawed. I don't like the fact that all of them are white. I've never liked that. It's. There's a couple things I do like about this movie a lot. I like that they explain that, okay. Because like I mentioned in the last episode of Space Force,
which
you can get on YouTube or your download app. Picard, in an episode of Next Generation, he actually has to go along with the Cardassian Peace Treaty and relocate a tribe of Native Americans.
Oh, yeah.
And I hate that episode. I hate that episode for the very same reason that Picard hates that whole idea in this episode. But there's a reason why Picard is going against what he just did in the, you know, a couple years ago, which is he's getting younger.
Yeah.
So he's acting out, you know, he's not as seasoned in this movie. So his wild mood swings are excused because he's being influenced by the planet's radiation. So there's like an in-continuity reason for why he's taking a different stand than he took 2 years ago. Now, I'm not happy that they're all white people and brown and beige, and I'm not happy about, like, because it's clear that they're trying to do like sort of an Amish riff. Like the Amish could be technologically advanced if they wanted to, but they choose not to. Yeah. They never give us a reason why these people have chosen not to. The book does. In the book, they explain that the whole planet was nearly wiped out and they're the last of their kind, and that they've beamed down here and they were given a second chance. So they're like, we're leaving technology behind because technology is the root of all evil. In this show, we just get, oh, if you make a tool to do something a man could do, you take something away from that. Like it's a plan. Like I know that this movie has weaknesses, but it's as close to Next Generation as we're going to get.
Yeah.
Probably ever on a big screen.
Right.
And I kind of love it for that.
Yeah.
Because Next Generation is flawed. Like it's a good TV show. I have more affection for it than Chris does.
Yeah.
But it is a flawed TV show, and it does have its moments of crude and humor that doesn't always work. Like I don't think having people say boobs and have Spinal say the line to Wolf is a great moment. It gets a couple laughs from people, but it does nothing for me.
Well, that's a great segue into the second thing I hate about this movie. If you watch the last couple seasons of Next Gen, like I did, you come away with one clear message: the deadliest thing in the universe is not the Borg, it's not the Romulans, it's not Q. The two deadliest things in the universe are Data and the holodeck. And if you get Data on the holodeck, you're dead as fucking red shirt. Because it's like every other week, it's either going to be the holodeck goes insane, Data goes insane, or Data goes insane on the holodeck.
Okay, you're taking me not wrong.
I think midway through season six, my friend Scott Connor, I've mentioned once before, who was always the great Trek plot hole finder of our group of Trek fans, it's like, how in the world could any dispassionate person look at this record and not have ordered all the holodecks disconnected and Data turned off years ago? Because they're both fucking menaces. And then here we go. We have a film where what are your two main plot elements? The holodeck and Data going crazy. And the thing is, not only do we not get to see Patrick Picard tear out all our hearts like we would have to wait until 2020 to see when he's forced to kill his friend Data, we get to see him and Data singing together.
Now,
because it's really not a Next Gen movie unless Brent Spiner is making a complete and total ass of himself.
Now, this is because Brent Spiner has a singing career and he wanted to do it in the movie. Isn't that why he sings in the movie?
Yeah, but you know what? I can load and fire a black powder musket. But yeah, you know, when I go to my fucking job, I don't insist that they let me show how I can load and fire a black powder musket when my job is to be teaching political science.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, it's like I can feel Brent Spiner's ego just smacking me in the face every single excruciating minute I have to put up with his unfunny comedy outlaw mud show bullshit. And it's just, I don't know what I want. I don't know. I started out like season six of Next Gen wanting to turn Data off. But by the time I got to this movie, I want to turn Brent Spiner off. I just like, the guy can act. Data is a great character, but you killed his arc when he put in the emotion chip. They just had no idea what to do with him. And here's the thing. Okay. Love to you, Brent Spiner. Even Brent Spiner complains about the fact that they went with the element of, like, this movie completely disregards the fact that Data's character arc is over and just tries to start it over again.
Yeah, right.
So I mean, here we go. So here's Brent. I mean, even Brent Spiner doesn't like what Brent Spiner did in this movie anymore. It's just like, why go back to the two most tired, overused, irrational, and annoying plot points from the burnout years of Next Gen? I just don't get it.
I also don't even remember in the actual plot why they explained Data goes insane in the first place at the beginning.
Well, there's a very brief mention at the beginning. And Picard asked Geordi, like, okay, so Data's malfunctioning. Is it the emotion chip? And Geordi says, he didn't bring it. Apparently, you could just, like, pull it out and leave it, right?
It was fused in the previous movies, so it could come out. Yeah.
Well, in the first film, it's fused, but in the second film, he can turn it on or off whenever he needs to.
Yeah.
And in this one, he apparently just takes it out and leaves it at home. But you're right. They do ignore his whole emotional plot development. Jim?
So there is an exposition scene between Geordi and Bacon when they're walking back to engineering after they've captured Data.
Yeah.
And I'm just gonna say I love that scene unabashedly. Love the shuttlecraft scene. Like okay. Moment to moment, like the fact that Worf is not into it until he realizes it's a fight song, and he's like, "Yeah, I'll sing along with the fight song." I love all of it. Like I can understand that's different of taste. I like silly sometimes. Yeah. That scene is silly, but I believe it's like two people trying to save their friend, right?
Right.
Like doing what they can to save the friend. Now they do explain that when he was shot, and he has that tail on his neck.
Yes.
That all he understood was his ethical subroutine. It's like a higher processor was knocked out, and all he understood was like good and evil.
Yeah. Minor. Yeah.
Yeah. That is actually in the text of the movie. They do gloss over it because then Geordi starts getting the headache, and that's the setup for the scene where LeVar Boynton can act. Like he's given a moment to act. He's given his like default Kelly like moment in the film, which is a nice callback to a previous episode of Next Generation of, you know, I'll never get to see the sunset, you know, sunrise like you do.
I'd much rather have seen the scenes of LeVar Burton wandering around commenting on the fact that the perfect society is all white people. I think those scenes would have played way.
Let's make that the movie, right? Like I want LeVar Burton to have as much screen time as humanly possible.
Exactly. Just LeVar Burton and Picard and Patrick Stewart in that scene is really good. Rather than just be like, hey, everyone's there, or it's just an offside comment, it's a purely Geordi scene. There's nothing else going on.
Yeah.
Now, by the way, quick thing.
Great moment.
Go ahead, Chris.
One quick thing. Real quick here. I will not and refuse to take credit for this, but for those of you that are fans of Red Letter Media and the Mr. Plinkett reviews, Mr. Plinkett has a supercut of why Data is the worst person ever to lead a first contact mission as this hilarious montage from the original series about how every time Data gets put one of these missions, he complains about it. He can't relate to human beings, and it turns to a total, complete, utter clusterfuck. And I've never been able to rewatch this movie again without seeing like this. Well, we have a guy who's got a proven track record of fucking up first contact missions. Let's send Data.
Yeah.
So love to Mr. Plinkett and everybody at Red Letter Media. That was one of the great takedowns of this movie, and well worth your time for free on YouTube.
Also, never explained why Data's there in the first place and why he's required for the actual mission.
No. Well, he's the worst one at first contact missions, of course.
And then to get back to this plot about Data's arc. We have these scenes with him and the kid, like the kid teaching him like how to play and like the reconnection and stuff. Now, to some extent, I see the charm in those scenes because Data is a lot of kids' favorite character on Star Trek, right? Like he's kind of there to be a man child that doesn't understand how the universe works, and he's kind of naive and innocent, and he is kind of a kid-like character, and he wants children to like him, and the fear that the child has and that the relationship with Data re-earning the kid's affection that ends in this scene with the two of them playing and Data's head popping up out of a haystack, you know. And what I love about the normalness of the scene when he's like, I have to go home now, and the kid's like, okay, because that's how kids say goodbye. Like there's no intense heart feeling. It's just, I gotta go now. I'm like, okay, well, I guess we'll see you later. But none of that makes any goddamn sense after the
Wasn't there something in Farpoint about with Data and Wesley that was very similar to that as well?
Maybe.
I remember the holodeck where he lifts him out of the water in Farpoint.
Yeah, he saves him from the holodeck. That was before they established the holodeck safeguards world thing.
Yeah.
And also he has an episode Being Human, I think. Well, suddenly no, it's Being Human. A crew member's parents have died, and he just sort of latches onto Data and starts mimicking his motions. Yeah. Oh no! He beats up his brother enough to put him in the hospital, and then he winds up having to like mimic like Data.
Interesting.
It's like putting Data with children makes sense. Like now that you say he's supposed to be this man child, type character. You know, I've always equated him in my mind to Pinocchio. But once you explain that, now my distaste for all that sequence of sexualizing Data and false contact, just like it just like knee jerk. Like now I have an explanation for it.
Yeah.
Outside of being sophomore, like it's sort of counterintuitive to where that character is.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, there's a couple things that I want to touch on before we run out of time. We've got about 45 minutes. But one of those things is the whole Riker sequence where he takes over the ship and we get the Riker maneuver and the sort of space action section of the movie, which I felt held up fairly well. It was the most action-oriented part of the film. It seemed to be directed okay. Do we have anybody have? Have you had to do any of this modeling in the Star Trek Adventures RPG or anything?
No, I didn't do any spaceships. I did put myself forward to do spaceships when it was to go, but I didn't get to do any spaceship stuff.
Fair enough.
Well, I tell you the thing about the space battles is
okay.
All right. There's a recurring thing in all the Star Trek movies. The ones that reuse familiar elements tend to be the more successful of them.
Sure.
Now, that's a very dangerous thing to do, because if you're not careful, you wind up being Star Wars and you wind up just being a member berry factory where, you know, the recycling is the selling point.
Yeah.
But there's something to be said from, okay, I've only got 100 minutes of screen time. I can either bring on Khan, where you immediately know who this guy is and why he matters. And by the way, I'm going to cast a great actor in to sell it, even if you're a newbie. You know, bringing in a whole new race and a whole new concept is a dangerous thing. You've got to have a great combination of great writing and great acting to make your audience care enough about that element. That's why we're going to be more into a movie about the Klingons than we are this Malcolm McDowell character that we've never heard of before.
Right.
And the problem, and I think my third and final point about it is, this is supposed to be an incredibly high stakes plot, and the key elements, we just don't give a crap about any of them. We don't give a crap about Smurf Village. We don't give a crap about the Baku. We don't give a crap about Picard's insurrection, because it's shown to be so low stakes, low risk, and low consequence.
Yeah,
it's like everything that is supposed to sell this movie from that weird quasi romance that Picard has with the woman that never worked again. The story elements of this thing that need to carry a ton of story baggage just can't manage it. I mean, at the end of the day, you don't give a fuck about any of this stuff. There's absolutely no gravitas to it at all. You don't care whether the Baku live or die. You don't care whether Smurftown lives or dies. We're not given enough to care about any of this stuff. So by the time that we do get the cool space battle, we just don't care who wins. I mean, it's just, unless you have some residual affection for the next gen. And at that point, I'm rooting for the guy from Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park, because I at least enjoy Kiss Meets the Phantom from the Park.
Okay, so go ahead. Sorry, Jim.
Eight,
all I was going to say was, it is the space battle. Obviously, we see crew members. We literally see pretty much two other crew members apart from Riker in the space battle. We see the security officer that fires the actual weapons, which apparently, unless I'm very much mistaken, is the same crew member from the previous movie.
Okay.
It looks very, very familiar. I don't know if it is or not, but it looks very familiar. And then we get the Trill, who's actually steering the ship, but I don't believe she actually gets name-checked in anything. I think it's just Ensign. I think that's literally all she gets. I don't think we get anything more than that. But again, my biggest thing, as I mentioned in the notes beforehand, is the freaking joystick. What the hell was that about? Why did they need it? Literally, it's like, okay, right, so I've got a huge spaceship. It's got one trigger on it and it's a joystick. You can do that. And then all he uses it to do is to vent the gas at the back. You don't need a joystick to do that. You just press the buttons on the console. There's nothing he actually fundamentally uses to do with it anyway.
The funny thing is, joystick is...
Hey, real quick, according to Memory Alpha, her name is Ensign Kel Parham.
Oh, cool. Okay.
The joystick is so, like, ridiculously small.
Yes.
It's like this little tiny hand joystick, and like, okay, I'm flying this entire starship. I don't know what it should look, what it should be instead. Like, if you're intent on doing something, do it like a Klingon periscope or something. I don't know what.
Why is it any better than the console? It makes
yeah, I know, but you're right. It's a silly little bit, and Riker's trying to give it some kind of gravitas as he slowly steers this, you know, this gigantic starship with a joystick.
He gets to do the Riker lean while standing, people. Come on. So the thing is, like, when, again, I watched this in the private theater.
Yeah.
Like, it's a very much a public theater, but it was a private show. And I remember going, oh, this is dumb. Like, this, like, I'm 15. Keep in mind, I'm like 15. This is the epitome of stupidity. And then he starts doing the Riker lean, and then Perrin, the ensign, starts doing the Riker lean. I'm like, all right, it's kind of cool.
All right, he sold you.
Neville revisits this. It never shows up again. This is the only time you see this bit of technology. There was no reason for it. I can't justify it outside of I think it's personally cool.
I can't imagine why they didn't use it again. All right. So the one last thing that I want to talk about. So I had this theory, and it's not particularly sophisticated, but when we're doing drama and serial films or serial television especially, and I think you're right, Jim, I think a lot of the blessings and flaws in this movie are deeply rooted in the fact that it's basically just a Next Generation episode that's 2 hours long. Mm-hmm. But when you have multiple romances in the same show, those romances have to be at different phases at the same time. So, for example, one of the romances is starting, one of the romances is in full flower, and another of the romances is falling apart. And every time one of them moves, the other ones have to move, right? So if the couple that had fallen apart, which was Riker and Troy, start getting back together, and that was probably this movie. That's this movie. Then some other relationship has to not come back together, right? Like, and that of course brings me back, of course, to Captain Picard and Crusher, or his flame in this. Now I realize that my holding the torch for Beverly Crusher is a hopeless thing. Like, I realize that.
I know we hold the die on.
I know. But he had multiple romances in the show, and everybody on that show had multiple romances. I mean, that was the thing about a series that goes for 7 seasons, right? 7?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
It goes for 7 seasons. It has 150 episodes or something. And that means that you're going to do the romance subplot with everybody multiple times, right?
You mentioned that. I still say that the most horrible example of that is Beverly Crusher and the ghost from Planet Island. Sorry. Rubbish episode.
You know, that was just cheesy. The one where you find out that Geordi has a holodeck version of Leah Brahms, he's basically like every dating guy on the internet, and then the whole episode is about how he can't grasp why she's offended and creeped out by that. That does not aged well. That actually is skeevier to me than just the cheesy ghost episode.
And so
the irony being as well is, sorry, just going back to the holiday, is that they did it with Reg Barkley later on with the Troy. It's like, oh, right, yeah. And then it was made to be an issue. And it's like, wait, Geordi did this 3 seasons ago. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
So in this film, we have a new relationship between Picard and what's her name?
Exactly. Right there. There's the problem.
The confusing thing about it is every time we see her now, I thought she was well written because the writers show her to be smart and perceptive. And I actually like the way the actress plays her because she's very subdued. So she's not overacting, you know, like she's very real. And I appreciated that. And I thought she did okay with the crap sandwich she was given. but when we see her, she is always with the dude. And you naturally assume that they're a couple.
Yeah.
And it's not until we get this explainer suddenly, like two-thirds of the way through the movie, that Picard's wandering around with her after he's already rescued her from the water and everything else. And he says, tell me why you didn't marry. And don't say it's because you never got around to it. We're like, wait a minute. Like, we've been wondering, like, what's going on with her and this other guy the whole time? Anyway, it's just, if you're going to set her up as a romantic interest and you don't want her to be married to the dude that she's in with in every scene with, then don't put him in the goddamn
Exactly. Also, you know, it's an interesting observation because there were two scenes where Picard and actress TBA actually kiss on screen, but they cut them because when they were watching the version of this movie that had the kissing scenes in them, they were like, the kisses just seem so out of left field given everything else that's going on in the movie. And I'm thinking, well, there you go. That shows you stuck the landing on that romance when it seems weird that your characters actually kiss.
What did you think about it?
So a lot of times when you watch these popcorn movies, and that's going to get to my closing point, but a lot of time when you watch these sort of popcorn films for popular entertainment, they force a romance. And there's no real chemistry between the actors. And I agree with you. I like the fact that she's downplayed. You know, she downplays her bit. Yeah, she gets a little closer to that, you know, I'm wiser than you kind of thing at some moments. Like when she's explaining, oh, you have to apprentice for 30 years.
I love that line where she says, like, I know what a... He tries to explain something to her, and she's like, I know what that is. Yeah. Right. I forget what
it is. He does that for the holograms.
Yeah, I know what a hologram is, yeah.
But it does allow Patrick Stewart to have that moment of explaining, like, what Picard's perfect moment was, which is leaving home, right? And that's a nicely acted scene. And I buy in the fact that these two people are attracted to each other by the way they play it. It's just... You're right. Like, the way you sort of run games is that way. Like, if two people have a romance...
Yeah.
If it's starting out, that romance is going to be strong, and someone else's romance in the group is going to be a little lessened, or there's going to be complications for that romance.
Well, otherwise, you're just telling the same story. If I can get Arthurian for a second, this is why movies tell either the Guinevere Lancelot Arthur triangle or the Mark Tristan Iseult triangle. Now, these are very different stories, but to a Hollywood screenwriter, it's just the same. It's just a romantic triangle. Like, it's just, okay, wife cheating on her husband with his best friend. That doesn't describe the Tristan saga at all. But when you only have 2 hours for a King Arthur movie, even if Tristan makes it in, which he almost never does, you never get a chance to actually show that romance in an interesting way. Now, if we go to something, a comic that's got more room is Camelot 3000, Mike Barr and Brian Boland's wonderful 12-issue King Arthur story, in which Tristan and Iseult are there. And that relationship is used to say something very different than the Guinevere-Lancelot affair. So in this movie, you've got the rekindling of the old flame between Riker and Troy, but then you have this other new relationship between Picard and what you call, to be announced, actors to be announced. And I don't know. I don't know.
And one of those relationships we are invested in as an audience member, who's going to see the third movie of a franchise that has seven more seasons of content.
Yeah.
But the fact that they'll split up for much of the movie, like Troy goes on the planet, and it's encapsulated in that little wave that she does, that little, like, I'm really happy to see you wave. And Michael has that moment of expressing second doubts, like, oh my God, if we leave Hale, does that mean that this is going to end? And it's Worf, the guy who had the quasi-relationship with her in the last season.
Yes.
And it's Worf who says, you know, you've always felt this way. This has just allowed you an opportunity to re-experience those emotions. And then he quietly walks off.
I know that
hobo statements.
I know that it was never going to happen, that it was never going to be sustained, but I dug the idea of a Worf-Troy relationship. like when I was watching Next Gen and I saw that happening in the seventh season, I was like, oh shit, yeah, I am all over that.
The backstory behind it is pretty funny too.
What is that?
Basically, Michael Dorn and Marina Sirtis were sitting around on the set one day. They would not put it in these terms, but realizing that the only people that get character development episodes on this show are Data and Picard. If Worf gets an episode, it's about him getting angry and killing a bunch of people. And if Troy gets an emotional development episode, she's either getting mind violated or the executive producer's wife comes on and steals all their thunder. Right. And it said like, well, why don't our characters just hook up since apparently, you know, they have no other plans for us, you know? So it's basically hooking up essentially out of boredom.
That's great.
Well, and the nice thing is that does also call back to Star Trek V, where Jimmy Doohan and Nichelle Nichols, the only reason they have a romance is because of the deep affection those two actors had for each other.
And that is that relationship never being picked up in future films is another great tragedy.
Never get wasted, yeah.
It would have certainly redeemed Star Trek V as much as anybody can redeem Star Trek V.
Aid, did you have any final thoughts on this film?
The romance and the backer in general is no one seems to have any kind of job description apart from the blacksmith guy.
Yeah,
right. There's a blacksmith. That's it. So it's not even like saying, "Oh yeah, I used to be an astrophysicist." That would give her some background, whatever. Anything like that. Same as we have with Lily. Lily, we don't know what Lily did on the planet. We've got no idea. She could have been an engineer. She could have been a freedom fighter. We have no idea at all. There's no background at all. She's just there.
They're all telephone sanitizers.
That would make some sense. Yes, they've all been excluded from the great Arkle Chaser. Yeah, so that would make some sense. The second thing is the idea of having this extended lifespan and you're apprentice for 30 years. So just be like, well, what a waste of time. Sure, you want to get to the job, the good bit of the job. You don't want to be doing the crappy bit of the job. You want to be doing the good bit of the job. So it's like, oh, you get to live forever, but you do the shittiest part of your life longer. Right. So that also annoys me about the backing.
Well, gang, we have gone an hour on this.
Let me put a bow on this.
Okay, Jim, you stated before this is one of your favorite films. So please, yes, take us out.
It's one of my favorite films in this franchise. And that's because I don't think you can make a good Star Trek movie outside of Wrath of Khan.
Okay, unpack that.
All right. So the closer you get to what I like about Star Trek, replicating what's on the TV show, the more clunkier the execution becomes.
I see.
Because I don't think Star Trek, like my wife is watching these movies with me. Yeah. And she's coming to me and she's like, I don't think I like these movies. I loved Star Trek when I was a kid. I would watch these movies all the time. But watching them now, like digesting them the way we're digesting them and seeing all the flaws, I said, because what you want to watch is Star Trek. And what we're watching is the motion picture version of Star Trek, which I don't think translates well to screen.
There is this argument about books and adaptations into film that you can't judge them as adaptations into film because the book will always be the best thing at being itself, right? Like it's the book. And so in the film, in this case, the film and the television in your comparison, like the Star Trek as a television show is the first origin. And so that's always going to be the best version of Star Trek is the television version of Star Trek. That's the best. That's when Star Trek is being itself.
Mm-hmm.
It tries to be a movie. It's trying to be something else. And it's never going to be as good. This is what you're arguing.
Yes. And like Wrath of Khan is the exception to the rule in the sense of if you watch all of Star Trek and then you watch motion picture and Wrath of Khan is nothing like the TV show. Even though it does bring back a villain from the TV show, structurally and thematically and tonally, it's drastically different.
Yes, that's right. There's no planet to explore. We don't.
Yeah. We're not exploring anything except our own mortality, right. Which you can say is a very Star Trek message, but we sort of adopted that into our lexicon because through repetition.
Yeah.
And you know, Jim makes some fabulous points as always. And you know, the virtues of Star Trek II derive from the fact that it's primarily made by people who were basically coming into the franchise pretty much cold. Yeah. And I find it highly tragic that they tried that they tried the same thing with Nemesis, which we're getting to next week, and it just completely and utterly blew up in their faces.
And I think that the Abrams was trying to reinvent Star Trek as a movie franchise instead of a television franchise.
Yeah, totally.
No, Abrams has one plot, Star Wars Episode IV. It was Abrams using his one plot on whatever he's handed.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
yeah, that's the movies always have to go bigger. There must be more explosions, more combat. That's what you mean. The idea you have an episode, like, can you imagine trying to do Measure of a Man on the big screen for 2 hours? No one would. I mean, some strict people go, okay, this is just like the TV series, fantastic. But the general public, yeah, they don't want to see that.
Well, Aid, it's like the version of Generations that we were talking about, which basically would be Blake 7 episode where it's Picard kills Kirk and then has to deal with the fallout for that for the next 2 hours. There's this great category of great Star Trek films that like three people would go to see. Mm. And the feature film version of Measure a Man would be one of those great films that, you know, five people would go see.
Now, Jim, you already set us up a little bit for the next film. You mentioned that it took 4 or 5 years for another movie to get made. Star Trek had been the sort of tentpole for Paramount, but after a disappointing couple of films, the tentpole was sagging pretty hard. And took them a while. They fell back and recalibrated, and they came out with a new film, Nemesis, which successfully killed the franchise for a day.
And I blame Nemesis. I blame Mission Impossible 2 for Nemesis.
Okay, well, you're going to have to explain that.
I'm going to unpack that next week.
No, but the funny thing is, Chris, you were mentioning this. Like, if you look at Nemesis without actually watching the movie, it sounds like it's going to be great.
Yes.
It's got a fantastic lead actor as a villain. I can't remember. I believe I've forgotten his name again.
Tom Hardy.
Bane.
Say it again?
Yeah.
Tom
Hardy. Tom Hardy.
Yeah, Tom Hardy. Bane. Who would play Mad Max and everything else. And it sounds like it's going to be fantastic, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's I'm from the pre-video age where you would read about movies and TV shows long before you ever got to see them.
Yeah.
And there's this phenomenon, I think, specific to people of that age group where you would read something, the synopsis of it sounds terrific. Like, yeah. I couldn't wait to get to the Colin Baker Doctor Who episodes, because I would argue the 2-sentence description of every Colin Baker Doctor Who sounds like it's going to be terrific until you actually watch it and it's the shits. The setup for Nemesis makes it sound like a classic Star Trek film until you actually see it and it's the shits.
Does anybody in our cast here like or enjoy Nemesis?
There was one scene in the whole film that I love and I will defend, and that will be the hill I die on next week.
What?
I've not seen it for ages. I know there's bits in it that I don't mind, and I'll have to be refreshed now. And just as an aside, I actually like Colin Baker as Doctor Who. One of my favorite Doctors.
There's nothing wrong with Colin Baker as an actor or his choices. I'm just saying every story he got was the shits.
He did have some clunkers, Paul.
Jim, what is the scene?
The scene is middle of the movie, Act Two, which, you know, usually Act Two is all not great. But it's Picard and Shinzon, his clone, having dinner in the Romulan Senate.
Okay.
From beginning to end. That scene is acted perfectly. It's written perfectly. There was not anything I would change in that whole scene. I just wish the rest of the movie that bookends that thing is worthy of that one sequence.
Yeah. Well, we will be back in 1 week to talk about Star Trek Nemesis before we jump off the cliff into 3 movies of J.J. Abrams. And it's going to be an interesting month. All right, so we will see everybody back next week. In the meantime, live long and prosper, my friends. Chris, you're up.
Yeah.